melting a recent storm into mush. So Robert Peck and I wound up sloshing our way to the old portion of Upper Campus. We did not exactly move as a team. I got the feeling that Robert, clutching his bag of provisions, was still tuned in to the full-speed-ahead rhythms he'd learned while proselytizing door-to-door on his 2-year mission to England. He hadn't been back in the States very long, and like many returned Mormon missionaries, he was still more accustomed to walking with a silent male missionary companion than a girl intent on talk. We finally came to a circle of trees that sheltered some benches, set into a little hollow. It was there we consumed our simple repast, swigging milk from the same carton, and began also to consume each other's eyes. Before too long, he'd taken my hand and begun to lead me back down the hill. We wandered, I think unconsciously, toward the Smith Field House. On this Sunday afternoon, it was unlocked and empty and dark. Robert Peck began to speak from his heart as we neared it. "The thing I want is to see God in this life," he said, with great earnestness. "To see him just the way I'm seeing you. I think he will show himself eventually if I live close enough to him every day, so it's very important that I keep myself righteous." I did not think this was strange, although I did think it was extreme, because at BYU the concern with God permeated everything, particularly courtship. I particularly did not think it was strange that attaining perfect faith seemed vital to Robert Peck, because I expected spiritual dedication from a member of the Mormon priesthood. All Mormon men are ordained to the priesthood, a designation that they believe has been passed down to them directly from Christ's apostles, one that endows them with mystical and supernatural powers, such as the ability to perform miraculous healings and exorcism. They also believe that their priesthood powers carry grave responsibilities for righteous living. I believed I was fated for this young man with whom I'd just spent my first hours. In the hour of soft sounds before we walked slowly back to the dorm, I became a fulfilled woman. For the first and last time, I experienced my life working out exactly as my parents and church leaders had told me since birth that it would. I was in Utah at last, and I was pressing every allowable part of my body against the chest and cheeks of a man whose skin made my own skin hum, and who, wonder of wonders, was that elusive thing, spiritual, and he was taking me seriously. I finally belonged. While I was growing up, it had seemed that I would always be outside life's window because I was religious. In the late 60s, my classmates at my Florida high school were the younger siblings of the chanting, swaying, agonized college insurrectionaries whose activism was transforming the country. And I, who poured all my own passion into following as exactly as I could a path paved with endless church standards for behavior, couldn't begin to understand or approve of them. I had spent those tumultuous years waiting for a more suitable context, huddled for companionship with the other Mormon teenagers I knew. My siege of waiting had ended only in the fall of 1970 when I had rolled triumphantly onto the BYU campus in my father's barge of a car. The entire rear compartment and even the window ledge were filled with the winter wardrobe that my mother and I had just spent an entire week collecting in Salt Lake City's most elegant emporiums. There was not a pair of blue jeans in the lot. This was because BYU, church-owned and arch-conservative, was not somewhere jeans were admired or even allowed. During a year when short hemlines were so accepted nationally that they'd become a uniform, BYU's strict dress code still forbade miniskirts anywhere on campus and mandated that young women could not wear slacks of any kind to classes. On the morning when I strolled on pristine walkways over to the field house and the welcoming assembly, I could hardly believe the sight that greeted me that day. I had now found 25,000 soulmates. I could not gaze enough at the hordes of college kids milling around me in their bright, neat sweaters and pressed skirts and slacks and well-polished shoes. And in an era when much of the university-aged world had embraced a concept of beauty that relied on the mixed blessings of nature, my new sisters and I were swabbed with a quantity of makeup that would have camouflaged burn victims. We were to be welcomed that morning by Ernest Wilkinson, the long-term, practically mythical president of BYU. He was a man of 70, a squat workaholic attorney of distinguished reputation. At the university where he had ruled for 20 years, he was notoriously authoritarian, a powerful-voiced despot, with the unfortunate manner of a pit bull.